Welcome to Barron Talks. I'm Chancellor Ralph Ford, and we have discussions with interesting people in the Penn State Barron community. And today, it is my great pleasure to talk to Jason Williams. Jason Williams is an assistant teaching professor in plastics engineering. He heads up our Medical Plastics Center of Excellence. He has worked in industry, and he owned his own design firm called K Development, and I want to talk a little bit about that today. But joined us here at Barron a number of years ago as a faculty member. Welcome here, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining. And, you know, I will tell our listening audience that this is the time of the COVID pandemic. So we're trying something new today in that we are recording this remotely. And so it's a little bit of an experiment for us. It's actually our second try. I know on this time we're going to get it right. So we'll see how it goes today. And now I can see you. I think it also helps a lot that we can see each other too.
Yeah, I agree.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your pathway to Barron and how did you get here?
Sure. I actually was a student on campus. I went to, I graduated in 1992 and actually started working on campus as an undergraduate. I started running a 3D printer that we had on campus, one of the first in the country. That we had on campus at the time, and I would work with companies to develop their products and design plastic parts and prototype them. And then after a few years of doing that, I left and started my own design and development company where we designed lots of different plastic products and consumer products and medical products, basically working with companies to help them create plastic products. And then in 2008, I came back to campus. The position was open in to teaching part design, plastic part design, product development. And so I came in and applied for the position and got lucky.
Well, I'm not sure you got lucky. We're happy to have you back and you've had a large impact. But, you know, you're talking about K Development.
Yeah.
Made me think quite a bit. That was a, you know, a great design firm. I think you still have it, but you designed a really famous part, a really famous toy, right?
When
you
were
at K Development.
One of the first parts we really got into, we had been doing some small projects and we got approached by a couple entrepreneurs from Toronto, that had a small startup company called Spin Master Toys. And they had a product idea that, from an inventor in England, and they asked if we could help. And it turned out it was the Air Hogs airplane. And so what it is basically you use pressurized air with what was effectively a small steam engine. So, instead of using steam, it used the compressed air to work. And so we had to take that design that they had and effectively design that to be manufactured as a toy. So very inexpensively with minimal components, minimal materials or lower cost materials. And so it had some fun design challenges. And so we started and we did that project. That was a fun project.
I mean, that was like a phenom, right? People were buying those all around the world.
Yeah, that really launched that company. They had a few small products ahead of time, but the Air Hogs really turned Spin Master into a large toy. Now you see them advertising all over TV. They have some huge product lines. So we're now one of the big toy companies in the world.
Wow. Now you also design medical products as well when you're with K Development, right?
Yep. Yeah, probably the most notable one that we worked on there is a company out of Pittsburgh called Body Media. And it was a wearable body monitor that we wear on your upper arm, and we did all the mechanical development on that. And the body monitoring would measure sort of calorie burn. It would measure, sleep quality and other things. And so we started with them, and that was quite a fun project.
Oh yeah. It was like, early days of, Fitbit, but far more complicated than that, right?
Yeah, definitely. It was, it had wireless uploading of data. And so this is right around 2000. So it was well before a lot of that. So it had heart monitoring capabilities. It would work in conjunction with one of the Polar heart straps. And then you could upload to a website. And it was really something else.
Yeah, that's pretty high tech, particularly for that time. It really is.
Yeah.
Now, in the last few weeks, you know, everything has changed, of course. We're teaching probably in about our fourth week now of what we call remote teaching and remote learning, something we didn't even know was going to happen 2 months ago. So You know, how's it going? I mean, how are the students doing? How are you doing?
I think, from my perspective, I think I'm doing pretty well. I've always been a bit of a technology nerd, so I always tried to have fast internet around the house. I've got several computers because I like to build them as a hobby. And so from that perspective, we were indirectly quite prepared for going to a remote teaching environment. So it was easy for myself personally. The students seem to have transitioned quite well as also. I mean, I think our students, they miss being involved actively in the class. That's pretty obvious because I think a lot of them like the interaction with the faculty. They like being in the classroom. But it's gone well. I know the one piece when I'm lecturing is sometimes I feel like I'm just talking to the webcam sitting on top of the monitor, but yeah. It's kind of hard to get a nice interactive discussion going with the students, but they're doing well.
You know, I think everyone is being remarkably patient and, it's not perfect to be sure. We know this across the world, but there's some really nice, like even stories out there, students who've just, you know, written articles and the like about appreciating what their faculty are doing.
I think the other piece that's coming, I've had near perfect attendance in these courses. So, I mean, because I do the lectures real time, you know, at the normal prescribed lecture time. And it's fun to see them all show up. They're interested. I'm getting questions, albeit they're asking those questions via the chat box.
Chat box. Oh, yeah. Well, it's less than ideal. Now, how about labs? Like, do you have a class with a lab?
Yeah, I do have labs. It's a computer lab. So this isn't, so it's computer aided design and that kind of work. So the students are doing well with that. There's been some challenges in terms of getting access to the CAD software in an efficient way. So it'll work, but it may be some of the part designs I'm having to do can be pretty complicated. So it's a bit of a challenge on that part. But what I've done is I'm treating a little bit like a seminar, and still hitting the topics, but I've assured the students, since I'll see this entire class in the fall, that by the time they graduate, they'll have all the content that we would always have, because I'm going to shift content from one class to another.
Now, is there anything like you've learned by doing this that you didn't expect? Like maybe you're going to incorporate into your regular teaching, or is it just back to normal?
No, I think I'm going to continue. I think I'll probably do a few lectures remotely in the future, because I think this is good practice for the students on how to interact in a virtual space, because I've been doing a lot of industrial outreach for the department and for the engineering department. And so it's, I do a lot of meetings digitally now, so I think it'd be good for the students to sort of learn to interact like this on a regular basis. So I'll probably do some of this remotely going forward.
You know, I saw this funny thing that, I don't know where it was, some meme or something. You know, what's been the impact of CEOs and chief technology officers and getting people to adapt remote working? And it's like, you know, very little. COVID, 100%, right?
So yeah. Oh, I know.
It's a pandemic to make it happen. Well, we all do really want to get back to campus, and it will happen. It's just going to take some time. Well, I'd like to switch to, you know, a recent project that you've factored prominently in, this face shield project. And as we know, that's personal protective equipment that healthcare professionals need. And you've got Case Western and industry. And I mean, this is just really fascinating. This is a great story. Could you tell our audience what this is about?
Sure. What we developed was, to cut to the chase a little bit, is we're now mass producing protective face shields. So not the filter mask portion. There's a whole other project going on in that space, but what we're working on are the protective face shields that you see the first responders and medical staff wear. And I got pulled into it actually from a faculty member at University Park had actually contacted one of our faculty members, and then it came to me. So it was a little bit of a roundabout, but they wanted to take the open source design that Prusa had released and convert that to be mass produced. So the 3D printers can make one of these face shields in maybe about 3 hours. And we wanted, that's obviously going to take either a lot of printers or a lot of time, and neither which are particularly practical. So we wanted to convert this to a design that we could use for injection molding. And at the same time, a local manufacturer, Port Erie Plastics, had reached out to Tim Kurtzway, the director of the School of Engineering, asking if there's anything they could do to help. And so it was kind of fortuitous that they reached out to us. And so we, I had sent them some files about a design that I kind of sketched around a little bit. And they said, hey, we're working with on the, almost the same thing. And so they put me in touch with Ian Charnas and Bill Rabbit from Nottingham Spur. Ian's from Case Western. And we started chatting, and we decided to sort of combine forces and work together to try to provide face shields for the Erie, Cleveland, and State College regions initially. And so we put our designs together. We put everything kind of in place, and here we have face shields. So the listeners can't see this, but I'm holding up for Ralph to see. I've actually got some injection molded samples here of the face shield itself. And we did this. We went from idea and first discussions to having the tooling cut and first parts. And I think we're at week 3 right now. So it's been pretty whirlwind.
That's an amazing story. And I mean, it's just an amazing path to design a product, to actually have it being produced. And it's being manufactured as of today, right?
Yes. Our first shipments are supposed to go out today on these. So Port Erie's doing molding of there's 3 components in this. There's a frame piece that kind of holds everything. There's a rubber strap that holds it to the head. And then there's a clear shield that snaps on to the frame. And the frame itself is being molded by Port Erie Plastics over in Harbor Creek. The shields themselves are being stamped by Munot Plastics. They're in the west side of Erie. And the rubber straps are coming from Moose and Rubber in over near Cleveland. And Bliley Technologies is actually putting all these together. So they're collecting all this stuff. They're rather running the supply chain for this. So it's really, watching these local manufacturers run is amazing.
No, it's really been, like, you did that in a matter of days. And also the other one that helped was the Erie County, just not to leave anybody out, Erie County Gaming Revenue Authority, which maybe a lot of people don't know what they do, but they basically take gaming funds, some of the proceeds, and they put them into economic development. So they came in really quickly too.
Yeah, part of this is to get the injection mold. It's a big giant steel mold that we use to form the plastic for the frame. And we went to so all these manufacturers are doing this at cost. However, there are costs to get this done. We have to buy the steel and pieces like that. And the so there was about a $6,000 investment needed for the tooling for some of these parts. And to really kick this project off, we didn't have the funding. We didn't have pre-orders for these things. So the Perry Wood at the Erie County Gaming Revenue they jumped on this. They had actually reached out to the university asking what we were doing and if they could help. So they've been really proactive. We put a grant application in, and they turned that around in 24 hours, which really kicked this project off.
Yeah, like I said, everyone just moved so quickly to make it happen. And I will tell you, full disclosure, I am on the board at Bliley, so I'm well aware of this product and project. But I also hear that there's been good news, and I think people are contacting you from around the country. Are they not?
Yes.
About this? They've heard about it. They want to know how to do it.
Yeah. Well, we made that available. So all the design, even our manufacturable design, is open source. So we put all the information on a website. It's whitelabelfaceshields.com. And so we put the data out there, all the CAD files. So if a group wanted to replicate this, they just have to find the manufacturers that they would want to use in their region and build the tooling and get to work. So it's been interesting. I've gotten contact. I have a student that I'm friends with. His dad's from Saudi Arabia, and his dad was looking at doing this there. I'm working with a doctor in India on another project, and he's looking at replicating this there. We've got some other groups around the country that are looking to do this as well.
Yeah, I mean, and it is one of those where you can create a product in fairly short order, like you say. You've got to be able to scale it up, and it really helps the medical professionals. You see it on the news all the time. You see people walking around with these transparent shields. I want to ask one more question about the design. Is the idea such that you made it so that, like, the transparent piece snaps on? Is that so they can take that off and put a new one on? I mean, how does it work in the field?
The materials we use can all be sanitized. The frame and the strap could actually be autoclaved. The problem is the PET that's used in the face shield, you can't really autoclave that. It'll just turn white. But you can sanitize it. So if you wanted to take the whole thing off and just do like a bleach dip or any kind of other sanitizing spray, you could use that. But it is designed to be sort of reusable in a sense, right? So it's designed to be cleanable and reused. It's not a straight up disposable part.
Oh, very nice. And this company, I want to go talk about how this impacts your classes, but I have one last question. This company, design company called Nottingham Spurk in Cleveland.
Yes.
Now, they're disciples of the IDEO design process as well, or design thinking. Is that true?
Correct. So they're a product development firm, and a lot of the product development firms really focus on user-centric design. So when they think about a new product, how it's going to use, they design it from the approach of thinking of how the user wants to interact with the project. And that's a lot of what Bill brought to the puzzles. He was really good at asking the questions about how is the user going to interact with this? You know, the snap off, the tear off piece. It, really combining that with the manufacturability. So when we all worked together on this, it kind of came together nicely.
Yeah, and the reason I bring that up is I'm just a real fan of that design method. As you know, I'm a fellow engineer and faculty member, and I used to teach design, and it's so applicable in all sorts of, you know, domains in the world, that from business processes to the like, but it really starts with trying to understand your customer. I think that's what sets you apart, is you're such a great designer in understanding how it's actually going to be used in the end.
It drives the product. It's, you know, because me as an engineer, I care about, well, how big does it need to be, and how much does it need to weigh, and how strong does it need to be? But you can't answer those questions unless you go back and ask the user, what do you want this product to be? I want it to be light. I want it to be easy to use. I want it to be, you know, be a certain color. But me as an engineer, I can't design to something that's light. What does that mean? So you build this chain. You build this. The user wants this, and then that translates to me deciding a specific value on something, and then I can design to that. So that's, I try to teach that to the students as well as we go through, you know, in my design courses. That's a common thread, is that always thinking about how's the product going to be used? Walk through the use. You know, it's always thinking about that perspective.
Well, that takes us really nicely into your class, because you've actually taken this project already, this face shield project, and you've integrated it into at least one of your classes.
All right. And so in the lab sections, I think the students, it's kind of uncertain. This is all of a sudden we're changing everything for these students. And so how do they respond? And I think a lot of them are trying to make sense of a lot of this. So I said, let's try to use this as a teaching tool right now. Here's a response that the university's having in this. But just from a practical standpoint, I wanted to show them how you could rapidly respond to a design challenge. So I would pull up the design in class, we'd review it. They'd ask questions about, well, how is that going to fit together? How's the part going to snap? And I'd review it. And I tried to use my labs actually as design review committees. So we put them together, I'd review it. They would give me feedback, ask me questions. And actually, there are several design changes we made to this as a result of my students asking questions in the class. It's always nice to bounce things off of people.
Yeah, and they get the real benefit of seeing it happen in real time. I mean, that's unusual too. So this is actually one benefit, we'll call it, of the crisis.
Yeah.
Things will come out that are, of course, you know, it's a difficult time, but there will be good things. How about like FDA approval and the like? Does a product like this need FDA approval?
This is just a shield. We're not claiming disease prevention. We're not claiming disease mitigation. It's really just, in a lot of sense, a glorified sneeze guard for a salad bar that you wear on your face. And so it's, where the challenge comes in with the FDA is if you were to claim that this would prevent COVID-19, for example, because then you're making a claim about a certain efficacy, and then we can't make that claim because it hasn't been tested for those specific pieces. But there are, the FDA is running exemptions for certain things right now for low risk devices. Yeah. So the face shield, or I should say the filtration mask, because everybody hears about, is the N95 masks. As soon as you call a mask, an N95 mask, it becomes a medical device, and it falls into a very regulated category. So the idea of us doing something like that specifically would be challenging.
I did want to talk about the creative process, and I think we got into it with IDEO and the like. You've been named on 5 patents. That's pretty significant. And how do those ideas come about? How did you end up with 5 patents to your name?
A lot of times it would be a customer would come to us and they want to develop a new something. And a lot of times through that process of working through the product development cycle, you have some spark of creativity. A lot of times it comes from combining ideas or maybe things that I've worked on in the past in terms of how a mechanism would work or how a detail would work. Or I always like the idea of being naive when approaching design. So that doesn't mean that I'm ignorant of what the design needs to be. It means taking it from a perspective, I haven't grown up developing toys, so maybe I can apply something from a different industry to creating the toy. And I think that's how a lot of invention starts to occur. You pull from different areas that we haven't traditionally worked, and that seems to help.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I wanted to get to is you have a really entrepreneurial mindset. You started at least one company, probably more.
I did. The first one I started was the original Erie Brewing Company. So that was started, I wanted to learn how to write a business plan, so we did that. And then,
And you're talking about the Erie Brewing Company that's now up.
So the original, 1994, that was our first thing, was the Erie Brewing Company and the Hopper's Brew Pub. So okay. A lot of the listeners probably don't remember Hopper's Brew Pub, but it's where the brewery is now. And then, I got out of that. We did K-Development for a while. And so those were the two primary things I've been involved with. Now I stick to teaching. That's enough. That's enough entrepreneurialism for me.
Well, you get to bring that wisdom, to our students. So are students interested in your entrepreneurial background? I mean, how do you teach that? How do you bring that to the classroom?
We have one big project that I do with it's a joint project that I conduct every year, every fall with, senior finance students and my students. We put them all together into teams and they have to invent a product and effectively write a business plan over the course of the semester. And so it's a really nice project to put these teams together. It's always fun because they kind of talk slightly different languages and things where we have the engineers speak and business speak. So it's to put them together and it's a good learning experience for them to work together on something. But we occasionally get some really creative ideas that come out of this and I'll start to encourage them, tell them you should go forward with this product. At their age, they should always try to start a business because they got so little to lose at that age.
And you've got some, you've got some students who have gone off and created some great companies too. And, Brock Allen is one right here in Erie too, right?
Yep. Yeah, he wasn't one of my students. He graduated before I got there, but he's definitely a Behrend alum that had done stuff. And then there's Ray Moses is another one of our students with Control Molding. And, we have several.
So, you're really connected to industry and you continue to do so. And, one of the things I'm always fascinated about, of course, is the connection between industry and academia. And, so what do you get out of it? I mean, you work with these companies, you've taken on this project and, what does Jason Williams get out of this process?
I like it because it keeps me current with what the needs and interests of the industry are. So working with these different companies, it really helps sort of guide some of the topics I teach. And then I try to feed back to these industry companies as well about what the students are interested in, what they're, kind of what they want to be like as an employee. Generational changes are always fun to watch as they kind of work their way through companies and such. But it's just something I've done it for so long. It's kind of hard to get away from wanting to be in catching up with industry and see what they're working on. And, it's just, you get that personality of like, I like to help these companies be successful because I guess indirectly it helps the community, which I like because I live here. So.
Well, it does so much. I mean, yeah, you learn a lot. You stay sharp. You find out what's going on and well, you've got a lot to bring. So let me ask you this. As we're getting close to the end here. What's next? What are you planning to do next?
Projects wise, I'm helping. There's another group on campus and at State College. They're working on a filtration mask, so I'm advising on that. And then I'm finishing classes. So we have I mentioned the joint project a little while ago. We have the final presentations with those. So, and then really getting through the remainder of the semester is a big one. I mean, one of the big time sinks with this transition is moving my tests online. So that takes that's a bit of an effort, but I do like the automated grading.
You've got to do that. You know, you've got to teach and every, you know, and that's a huge part of your job, you know, this certainly brings a lot. So how about this one more question I wanted to ask. So what's like, you know, what should people know about our plastics program? I mean, it's a well-known program, but maybe anyone out there listening, what are the things that you think are important for them to know?
Well, I think the one piece is we're one of six accredited programs in the country. So we're kind of a rare bird in this. And I think the other piece is, at least from my perspective, is that the students that come out of our program are such dynamic, interesting people. I don't know. They get out of the program and I just love to watch them interact because they go to such diverse areas of the industry. You know, we've got students that go to process engineering. We have students that go to graduate school for materials. We have students that go off to product development space. I've got one student that's going to University of Georgia, I think, for environmental science because he wants to work on tackling the plastic pollution problem. So it's just a really natural fit for a whole wide variety of interests. So,
well, you know, two things you bring up. One is I love, you know, when I was engineering school director, I always loved going to the plastics alumni reunions. Mm-hmm. I've always said, I think it's such a close-knit group. And, you know, I don't know that you'd find an alumni group in the country. I'm sure there are some. But, boy, you're way up there in terms of engagement. Now everybody stays together and all the great things they're doing. But they come together, like, once a year.
Yeah, I kind of call it like the biggest small industry because it's this massive industry, and yet you very quickly know lots of people in all different aspects of it very quickly. And, you know, it's like they talk about the 6 degrees of separation. Well, there's about the 3 degrees of separation for plastics alum. You can always find a Penn State plastics alum somewhere.
Well, I tell you, I went to a conference one time, one of your trade shows, and I remember somebody from industry coming up to me and saying, "You guys are like everywhere, you Penn State Barron Plastics graduates." So that was just a really nice comment. My last point I would make is the one around plastics pollution. And I think that's important for people to understand. There's a lot going on in that space, and we're trying to solve really big problems there too.
Yep. So we've got, right, so we're now part of this Advanced Resource Efficiency Center, which is a large group out of UK. We're the U.S. representation for that. We've got, even just at the campus level, we have, we've started, and it's not just plastics, it's a campus-wide initiative where plastics is just involved with it in terms of setting up our own on-campus recycling system to collect PET bottles and the caps and then actually convert those actually back into materials that can either be sold back into industry for reuse or used on campus for teaching or other work. So in other words, we're trying to just capture that whole plastic pollution stream.
Yeah. It is a big problem, but there's more to come on that. I think more, a whole lot more. So yeah. Tell people it is something that is being addressed, and it's such a large problem that a lot of resources are being put into it to be sure. So Jason, I do want to thank you. This has been a great conversation today. Again, my guest today is Jason Williams, assistant professor in our plastics engineering program. You've been listening to Barron Talks. Great conversation, Jason.
Thanks so much. This was fun.